From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a computer system named Midas wrongly accused tens of thousands of people of unemployment fraud, the price of automating the unemployment claims system.
It's a little hard to say how much of the blame you put on the system and how much you put on the state for basically using it without human supervision.
There's just so many ways that Midas has gone wrong and failed the workers of the state of Michigan.
The EPA brings scientists together to review Flint water.
The system is getting better in every respect.
And we meet the new Speaker of the State House.
I'm willing to work with anybody from any district and from any party to solve Michigan's most pressing problem.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. So glad you're with us today. The state legislature begins the new session today with a lot of fresh faces, and that includes the new Speaker of the State House. We'll introduce you to Tom Leonard. Also later in the hour, we talk with a senior EPA official about the big meeting in Chicago on Flint and what's ahead for the beleaguered city. But first, a report from the Auditor General says Michigan's unemployment insurance agency is not doing enough to collect delinquent taxes from employers. Now, this comes after the agency director was reassigned last week after it became clear tens of thousands of Michiganders were falsely accused of unemployment fraud by a faulty computer program. And yet the state, led by Attorney General Bill Schuette, is fighting a class action suit filed on behalf of the victims of this computer system. Let's sort this all out as we welcome Paul Egan of the Detroit Free Press. Paul, tell us more about the Auditor General's report from today. What has not been happening?
They haven't been doing a good job of going after employers that don't pay their unemployment tax. And this is a tax that employers pay based on how many employees they have. A certain percentage of their payroll goes towards paying unemployment insurance benefits when somebody goes out of work.
So at the same time the unemployment insurance agency isn't doing what it should to collect unemployment taxes from employers, we find out it went way too far in accusing unemployed Michiganders of cheating the system.
Right. And in terms of going after the employers, these were findings that were made 5 years ago, that there was a very comprehensive audit that found. It was interesting because the agency said, well, we didn't have enough staff, but the auditor found that, you know, they spent all kinds of time filing liens. When an employer is behind on their taxes, one of the things that you can do is put a lien against their property so that they wouldn't be able to sell the property without paying what they owed first. But what the auditor found at that time was that they were filing all kinds of liens in counties where the employer didn't own any property, which meant that the liens had no value. And you know, the report that came out today found that a number of these collection issues have gotten better, but there's still a lot of problems, including this one of filing liens against employers in counties where they don't own property.
So basically, a lot of wasted time and effort in that respect. And then this computer system called Midas, the Michigan Integrated Data Automated System, went online in 2013. What was the idea? Get a computer to do what a salary drawing person was doing?
A large number of salary-drawing people actually lost their jobs when Midas came online. And Cindy, interestingly, it came on in 2013 on the benefit side for the workers. It actually came on a year earlier than that in this area that we're talking about. It actually handles both areas. So as early as 2012, it was involved in keeping track of what employers were paying required taxes. But starting in 2013, it started handling the benefit side, and it's a little hard to say how much of the blame you put on the system and how much you put on the state for basically using it without human supervision, which is what the state basically admitted they did between 20,000 and some, and possibly as many as 50,000 people being wrongly accused of fraud.
As you point out in your piece in the Free Press, to top it off, people are falsely accused of fraud. And Michigan has a 400% fraud penalty, so that's the highest in the nation.
Correct. So you actually have people that collected unemployment insurance for a short period of time. The most you can actually get it in Michigan is for 20 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Never notified that they had any problems with their claim. In some cases, the unemployment insurance agency notified them through the online system that they used to collect their benefits. Well, once you've stopped collecting, why would you ever go back to you know, go back to that web page to see if you've got any messages from the state agency. And then the first they find out there's any problem at all in many cases is when they're perhaps are back working now, they're waiting for their unemployment or for their income tax refund. It doesn't come. They wonder why, and they eventually find out from the IRS that the state of Michigan has seized their income tax refund for penalties and unemployment insurance benefits that the state was falsely claiming that they never should have received.
Paul, is anyone in Lansing working to help people wrongly forced to pay the state back money and penalties?
Well, they've given a new toll-free number that people can call again, and this has been one of the issues raised in the audits. You can't get a live person on the phone, even on this new number that's intended to help these people. You have to call and leave your name, your phone number, and a case number, and somebody is supposed to call you back within 48 hours. As you mentioned, they've reassigned the director. She was replaced last week, although she's still got a job doing special projects. And they say they're doing a top-to-bottom review of the agency. The changes are certainly not happening at a dog-ear's pace, as is a term that the governor sometimes likes to use.
We should actually add the governor just signed a bill dipping into the unemployment insurance contingent fund to help balance the budget to the tune of $10 million.
That's true. At the same time, he also did sign a law that will prevent the agency from ever again accusing somebody of fraud without having a real person review the computer's findings. So I guess that is one bright spot in terms of the new laws.
Paul, have you heard anyone talking about making the vendor who supplied that computer system that did such a bad job liable for repaying these people?
That's an interesting issue, and again, we get back to this question of, you know, to what extent is the system faulty and to what extent is it the way the state used it? This is a Colorado company. One of the things that I'm told is that the system was put online very quickly and that some of the support staff was sent packing sooner than some of the employees felt that they should be, and that people weren't familiar enough with how the system worked. I think that's a whole area that I certainly want to explore a lot further. To what extent is this a system problem with the software itself, and to what extent was it more a case of this thing being rushed in and the system not being used properly in terms of having enough human supervision?
Paul Egan, Detroit Free Press, always great to talk with you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Royal Oak attorney Jennifer Lord. She's filed the class action lawsuit on behalf of those falsely accused of unemployment fraud. Jennifer, where does the suit stand right now?
We are currently pending in the Michigan Court of Appeals. We're waiting a date for oral argument, and we expect that to happen any day.
Now, as we heard from reporter Paul Egan, the problems with MIDAS, this computer system falsely accusing people of fraud, may go back as far as 2007. He said up to 50,000 people could be affected, but the statute of limitations limits who can be part of the suit?
That's true. One of the things that we learned when we instituted the case is that when MIDAS went online in 2013, it started doing a six-year look back or a six-year audit. So an individual who collected unemployment benefits in 2007, a decade ago, would have just a routine audit run. And then again, remember, this MIDAS system is just so over-selective that if it picked up any discrepancy between what an employer reported and what an employee reported, it would automatically tag those claims as fraudulent. And if you think about it, that's one of the really, really big problems in this case, is that back in 2007, think of the number of people that have moved. There's just so many ways that MIDAS has gone wrong and failed the workers of the state of Michigan.
And I think about the depths of the recession, and people were so desperate at that time.
They were desperate then, but when you think about it, anyone who files for unemployment is desperate. And we have heard such heartbreaking stories from the plaintiffs that call us. People have lost their homes. They've pled guilty to crimes because the UIA is going after them for criminal fraud and will step in at the last second and say, hey, we'll cut you a deal. Plead guilty to a misdemeanor. You don't have to pay the quadruple penalty anymore. Just pay us back what we paid you in unemployment benefits. And this is someone who didn't do anything wrong who is pleading guilty to a crime. There's a whole other category of people out there who just just were deathly afraid when they started receiving these massive communications from the UIA. Mm. And all the communications include this threat to prosecute them for both a misdemeanor and a felony. And thousands of people have just gone and paid back the money the state says they owe them because they were afraid. And we now know that the state admits it was wrong 94% of the time.
Yet the state is still fighting your suit.
They're still fighting it. They have a whole team of attorneys just fighting it tooth and nail, taking us all the way up to the Court of Appeals. And that is just very common when you litigate against the state of Michigan. It's delay, delay, delay. And I think what needs to be done here is the opposite. It's time for the agency to open up and become truly transparent. Let's let the people, let's let the workers who rely on this, let's let the taxpayers whose money also goes to fund unemployment benefits, let's let them know what is going on here and how the state really is, if it is, working to fix this problem.
That statute of limitations is such an issue because anyone who had money seized from then on September 9th, 2012 or later can be part of it. But if it was back as far as 2007, are those folks truly out of luck?
Well, our legal team is brainstorming this, and we just have so many dedicated attorneys who have been doing this for years without charging anybody. The Sugar Law Center, the University of Michigan Unemployment Project, everyone has just really pulled together to try and help this 50,000-plus victims who've been wrongly accused of a crime. And we're going to do everything we can to help everyone in that class. For a variety of reasons, this particular lawsuit had to be brought in the Michigan Court of Claims. And the Michigan Court of Claims has a very specific statute of limitations. So as far as we could go back was September 9 of 2012. But we are certainly looking for ways to help everyone and, frankly, just imploring the state to do the right thing by these people. They admit they're wrong. Pay them back. And pay them back 100% of what they took, because that's another thing that we're getting a lot of calls about, is that in the few instances where people are getting their money back, they're not getting everything that was seized. You know, maybe $8,000 was seized from someone's tax returns over a couple-year period of time, and they're getting a check for $5,200. This is, again, where we need a level of transparency. What's happening with the portion of the money that's not being refunded?
Attorney Jennifer Lord, we have lots to talk about. We will keep monitoring this with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, the new Speaker of Michigan's House. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is a new year and a fresh start for Michigan's legislature. The 99th legislature began work today at noon. In the State House, there are 43 new members and a brand new speaker, DeWitt Republican Representative Tom Leonard. And he's here with us now. Mr. Speaker, welcome to Stateside, and thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Before we get into what you feel are the big items on your agenda as House Speaker, I was hoping we could talk just a little about you for people who aren't from the DeWitt area, a chance to get to know you a little bit better. And I'm wondering, did you always harbor a desire to run for elected office?
No, I did not. In fact, so if you go back, I grew up in a small town called Montrose, just north of Flint, and I got the bug at a young age. I really wanted to go to law school, and once I went to undergrad at the University of Michigan, I have no idea why, but I really had a strong passion for sports and entertainment, and I really wanted to be the next Jerry Maguire. I was going to head out to law school, and I wanted to be a sports entertainment lawyer, and one thing led to another, and while I was at the University of Michigan, I started interning for a then up-and-coming young congressman by the name of Mike Rogers, and I interned for him for about 3 months and really got the political bug, and it was really during that internship that I gained a passion for politics, but I didn't know if I was going to run for office. And then a couple years later, went to law school at Michigan State, and during one of our moot court competitions, one of the teachers grabbed me, or the professors grabbed me and said, hey, I think you would do very well in the courtroom. Have you ever looked at interning for a prosecutor's office? And I said, no, I haven't. And I applied for a position or an internship in the Genesee County Prosecutor's Office, did that for a summer, absolutely loved it, wound up becoming a prosecutor. And I thought that's what I would do for the next 10, 15, 20 years. But life took a turn. The good Lord had different plans, and here I am.
Here you are. You are not the new Jerry Maguire. You are the new Speaker of Michigan's House. So what do you see as the most important role that you will play as Speaker?
Well, you know, one thing that I have really been talking about as the leader of this chamber, not just, you know, Speaker of the House is not just the leader of the group and majority, the Republicans, but also the Democrats. I've got to lead this chamber. And one of the things that I have really been harping or pushing is bringing more civility back to the political process. As you know, this was probably one of the most uncivil election cycles that we have had in our nation's history, all the way from the local to the national level, and it was on both sides. It wasn't just one side. I believe it was both sides. So one of the things that I've really been pushing is making certain that we bring civility to the process. I know that Republicans and Democrats are going to do our battles over the next 2 years. I think we all know that. We've got a very big election cycle coming up with everything open at the top of the ticket here in the state, as well as the House and the Senate. And we've got to make certain that when we are tackling those big issues, we conduct ourselves in a way with so much respect and so much dignity that when the sun comes up the following day, we can come together, come back to the table, and work on the next big issue together.
I want to talk about what you feel are your top priorities over the next 2 years, big on your agenda. You certainly have talked a lot about the need to change the teacher pension system and the municipal workers' post-retirement health care. And it didn't get done in lame duck. Why not?
Yeah, so let's talk about, you know, the teacher pension first. And you know, you've got two separate issues, and that is one of my top priorities. And the reason being is we've got a situation right now where our teacher pension system is costing our local school districts about 36% of the payroll. And that is something that is unacceptable, unsustainable, and, you know, if you had any other business or anybody in the private sector that had that type of number going out of their payroll, they wouldn't be in business very long. And we've got to make certain that we scale those costs back so that we can get more money into the classroom and hopefully get our new young teachers pay raises. Now, one fallacy I do want to set straight, I've had several teachers come to me because they read this in the news and they say, why are you trying to take away my pension or why do you want to do this? That is false. Current teacher pensions are constitutionally protected. No pension would go away. What we are trying to do is stop the bleeding, get the system shut down for the new incoming teachers, get them into a 401k system so that we can get more money back into the classroom. Now, you would also asked about the OPEB liability situation for our local governments. And that is something we've got to take a strong look at. I believe overall statewide, we've got about $12.1 billion in OPEB liabilities out there for our local units of government. And I will tell you, I think probably the reason that that died in lame duck was the timing just wasn't right. It was too quickly. We had not brought the right people in to have the discussion. And to Speaker Cotter's credit, at least he got the conversation started. And I actually met with the police and fire associations during lame duck when I knew this was going to be a very big uphill climb. Myself and now Speaker Pro Tem Chatfield, who was working on that bill at the time, agreed to put the brakes on it, put the pause on it, and bring everybody to the table this winter or this spring. And I'm glad to say it wasn't too long after that that the governor actually stepped forward and said he wanted to put together a work group. So certainly this is something we've got to talk about. When we look at Lansing, and that's the example that I use, I think the last numbers I saw, $451 million in OPEB liabilities and only 14% funded. That's something we've got to address, and if we don't, cities like that will go bankrupt, and all of our retirees will lose the health care that they worked for, and we cannot let that happen.
I think a lot of people did feel that changing the rules on retired police and fire and other municipal workers was cruel.
Well, it's something, again, we have got to address this. We've got to make certain that these cities don't go bankrupt, because at the end of the day, if they do, our hardworking retirees are going to lose everything that they have. And there's certainly a lot of good arguments to bring to the table. I mean, for instance, I had one of the association members call me because one of the things that they were talking about was having retirees pay 20% of their health care. And they said, well, have you considered this? There are some retirees out there that have six-figure pensions. Not many, but there are a few. And there's also few that have pensions that are under $12,000. So when you look at somebody paying $4,000 for a $20,000 health care plan, somebody that has a six-figure pension is going to be able to pay that much easier than somebody with a $12,000 or $14,000 pension. So this is the discussion we have to have. Again, we've got to solve this problem. We've got to bring people to the table, and I'm committed to doing that to ensure that we keep our local government solvent, but also make certain that those retirees that work so hard for that health care make certain that they don't lose it all in a bankruptcy.
Speaker, you've been vocal about the increasing number of mentally ill inmates in Michigan prisons, and we've got numbers from the Corrections Department that they're saying between 2012 and 2016, we got a 14% increase in the numbers of prisoners who've been diagnosed with mental illness. What are your thoughts? Where would you like to see us go from here?
Well, certainly, and this has become a big issue for me, and I am so proud. I was able to work for Jenny Barkey, who is the probate judge in Genesee County. That was the first job I received out of law school, even before I became a prosecutor. And she started the pilot program for the mental health courts here in Michigan. And I will be the first to say, one thing you will learn about me is I will tell you if I'm wrong. And I remember when she started that mental health court, and we went to the first day of session, and I went back to her chambers afterwards. I said, Judge, this is never going to work. And I'm proud to say I talked to her a few months ago, and she now has an 80 to 90% success rate, dozens of individuals getting the help they need, getting back on their medication, looking for jobs, finishing their GEDs, finishing their diplomas. So one thing we need to look at, and I don't claim to have all the answers to this problem, but we've got to look at earlier intervention. You know, we can look at addressing the prison population, but the bottom line is this. Once somebody has committed a heinous crime, once they've killed somebody, once they've harmed a family, at that point, it's too late. We've got to get folks the help they need before they commit that crime and cost us nearly three times what the average inmate is. It's not only the right thing to do, but it's a huge cost savings as we go forward for our prison system.
So you're really talking about an overarching theme about delivering better mental health care in Michigan.
Absolutely. And what I have found and what I learned through that mental health court, and again, I'm no expert on this. I'm no psychiatrist. I'm no psychologist. But what I have found is many of these individuals, they are much different people when you get them on their medication. And I am a firm believer that many of those that are currently in our prison system that are going to be locked up for decades, had they just been on their medication, they probably never would have committed that crime because they are much different people when they're on their meds. And we've got to realize that this is a problem. Again, I don't have all the answers, but I'm committed to at least getting the conversation started and doing everything I can over the next 2 years to help us move the ball forward to help those that are mentally ill.
I'm talking with the new Speaker of Michigan's House, Speaker Tom Leonard. And one thing that did not get done last session was expanding Michigan's Freedom of Information Act to include the governor and the governor's executive staff, and also setting up a new legislative Open Records Act for lawmakers in the legislature. What do you want to do, if anything, on transparency and opening up FOIA laws?
Certainly, I supported that package of FOIA bills, and I will continue to support them. Right now, our caucus is currently in the process of putting together our action plan. They know where I'm at on the issue, and I think this is going to have to be a broader caucus discussion. Certainly, if the caucus wants to go that route, then I will support it 100%. I have intentionally left my top three priorities to three particular issues, and I've done that intentionally because I know that this is going to be a team effort. We've got to come together. We've got to set our agenda, and hopefully that is something that our caucus will want to take up. I support it, but we'll see where the caucus wants to go.
I want to pivot over to the Flint water crisis, which certainly is by no means over. I'm wondering, as you've seen this unfold, Mr. Speaker, how would you characterize the state's response and the legislature's response in general to Flint?
Well, I believe the legislature has done everything that we can and what's been asked of us at this point. I mean, as soon as we learned last term that this crisis was brewing and it became apparent to us as a legislature, we immediately appropriated, I believe it was $10.5 million to make certain that Flint was switched over to a different water source. And I've had very good conversations with Senator Ananick about this, who I know represents that district. I believe he knows, and I've been very, again, upfront that because I'm from that area, because I prosecuted in that area, Michigan has a speaker that has a very big spot in my heart for the city of Flint. There are a lot of great people there, and the legislature has responded. I believe we've appropriated at this point nearly $250 million, and we are going to continue to do everything we can to solve this problem and make it right. But we've got to make certain that we're doing so in a way that's going to protect our taxpayers. We can't just throw money at the problem for the sake of throwing money at it. We've got to do so the right way. But again, the Speaker of this House is committed to making certain that we make this situation right.
What more do you see from where you sit? What more do you think needs to be done for Flint and in response to this water crisis?
We've got to continue to do the proper testing to ensure that clean water is going into every house. We've got to continue to make certain that we're delivering water to the residents of that city. But most importantly, we've got to make certain that that city gets back on the right track and they are doing the right things in terms of investing in their infrastructure. I mean, one of the things that I have said is that this was a colossal disaster all the way from the local to the federal level and everything in between. This was a total government failure. And, you know, to Governor Rick Snyder's credit, he is the one person that I have seen that stood up, raised his hand, apologized, took responsibility, and said, let's get this right. So certainly we've got to make certain that the testing is happening and that we're getting clean water to the citizens of Flint. Again, I'm willing to do anything I can to help make this situation right.
To your point, I want to take you a little further into that. You mentioned a desire to see more civility in dealings, in political dealings in Michigan. Certainly a lot has been made about what many people see as a widening rift between Republicans and Democrats. How do you expect the relationship to play out between you and Sam Singh, the House Democratic leader?
I believe it will go very well. It has gone well so far. One of the big things that I think we can all do to bring civility, not just in the political process, but as you know, it always brings peace even at home, is to make certain that we are communicating. And Representative Singh and I have done a great job communicating. We've already had several meetings together. They've gone very well. You know, I believe he's got the best of intentions in his heart. I believe we both do. Sometimes we just have different ways of wanting to get there. But I believe I've got a good and honest partner in the House over on the other side of the aisle. He and I have worked closely together in the Capitol Caucus here in Lansing. So I would expect that the relationship is going to be great going forward. Again, and I'll be upfront about this, and Sam and I have admitted this. We know that we're going to have our battles. And But when we do, we've got to make certain that we are doing so in a respectful and dignified way so that the following day, once that battle's over, we can come to the table and we can start tackling another big issue together.
And you know, knowing that the Republicans have held the majorities in both houses, they're still recognizing there are people throughout Michigan who strongly feel that Democratic lawmakers speak to their concerns, people who support Democratic initiatives, which haven't tended to get very far in a GOP-controlled legislature. Is there a space for that give and take, that compromise that used to be the way things got done in Lansing?
Well, I'm willing to work with anybody from any district and from any party to solve Michigan's most pressing problems. And, you know, one thing I can say in terms of the bipartisanship, and I'd have to look at the numbers, but I believe when you look at what we solved and accomplished last term, yes, there were a few issues that were strictly partisan, if you will. But the vast majority of issues that we tackled over the last couple of years, I believe it was over 85 or 90%, were bipartisan. I mean, I look back to two terms ago when I took the reins and started working on the preliminary examination system here in Michigan. Now, that was a situation where folks said, Tom, you can never get it done. We've tried for decades, and it's simply never going to happen. And that's basically the starting point in the criminal justice process. And I'm proud to say that when I worked on that particular issue, we found out the reason that it was so contentious is because nobody had ever gotten the prosecuting attorneys and the District Judges Association in the same room to talk about the issue. Once they did, they emerged with a wonderful compromise. At that point, I approached the ACLU and the defense bar. They thought it was a great compromise, and I believe that legislation passed unanimously in the House, and there was only one no vote in the Senate. So again, this is about bringing people to the table. It's about open communication, and I believe when you have those open lines of communication, that's how you're going to get the best bipartisan policy.
What did you learn from your predecessor, Kevin Cotter, about what to do and what not to do as Speaker of the State House?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, it's so hard to look back. And, you know, and I don't want to compare myself to any prior leader, whether it be Kevin Cotter, whether it be Jace Bolger. What I would say is I can only speak on behalf of myself. You know, I know Speaker Cotter had just a very, very tough 2 years. When you look at the two members that we had to expel, when you look at the Detroit, not just the water situation, but the Detroit public school situation, he had a lot on his plate. So I'm looking at going forward. That's where I'm at with this.
As you enter your final term, I'd love to get your thoughts on term limits. Are they a good thing, or do we all lose out because just about the time that a lawmaker has gotten enough experience to be seasoned, it's time to go?
So what I would say, and hear me out on this, I am actually a firm believer, and I actually advocate, and I am for term limits. What I would say is this. I believe any good thing can be critiqued and be made better. One of the proposals that I liked a few years ago was when then-Representative Bill Rogers proposed a resolution, but to basically say we're not going to expand the number of years a legislator can actually serve, and that being 8 in the Senate and 6 in the House, that being 14. But what we would do is, under this proposal, is allow you to serve 14 any way that you want. So you could serve 14 in the House, 14 in the Senate, but after 14, you're out of here. And I think that would be a good compromise, because what I've seen is in the House, you've got a lot of members that would like to stay here, really work hard, but that Senate seat opens, and as soon as it does, they know that they've got to jump, because that's the one opportunity that you have. I think if we could look at a proposal like that that would just keep us at 14 years but allow us to serve the way that, serve in either chamber, I think what you do is you'd stop a lot of this turnover and you'd get a lot better work product.
Michigan's new Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, we want to thank you for spending time with us today on Stateside, and I certainly look forward to us being able to talk again.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day and anytime, okay?
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There was a big meeting yesterday at the EPA Region 5 office in Chicago. They spent the day focusing on and reviewing the Flint water disaster, looking at the science, seeing what's been done and what comes next. Robert Kaplan is the acting regional administrator for EPA Region 5. He's here with us now. Welcome to Stateside. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You had a long, full day of presentations and discussion. What did you view as the mission statement for the day?
So the most important thing that we want to do is follow the science. That's what I said at the beginning of the crisis, and that's what we're doing now. We want to get all the people that have produced data together and have a very full, robust discussion about that data.
So you got you heard from a lot of different voices, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, Dr. Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech, EPA experts from the city of Flint, Centers for Disease Control. So what did they tell you? What did the data tell you, and what is the science telling you?
So there are a number of initial conclusions. The most important one is that the system is getting better in every respect, and just to break that apart a bit, for lead, which was the initial thing that we were so concerned about, levels have really dropped off considerably. So from the high of August of 2015 until the most recent sampling, we see it down by more than two-thirds. If you look at the action level, which is 15 parts per billion, 96% of the Tier 1 homes, which means the homes that have lead service lines, by the testing that we did, confirmed by others, are below the action level. So that's all really good news. Breaking it apart even further, if you look at chlorine, which is the most important disinfection aspect of what the city adds to the water system, chlorine residual has gotten much better. It's very difficult to keep chlorine in the system, especially where there's corrosion. Chlorine tends to interact with iron and other components, get absorbed before it can do its work of disinfection. And for that reason, we were very concerned that there was corrosion in the system and the chlorine wasn't making it throughout. And what we learned today is that chlorine continues to improve. That's for a whole number of many reasons. So all really good news. There could be a downside to adding chlorine, and that's disinfection byproducts. And we also heard today that that's not a concern. It's really being managed very well. So overall, the system is looking much, much better.
So as you're saying, lead is down and chlorine is better able to do its job of disinfecting, but you're not getting the harmful byproducts that we saw at the end of 2014.
That's correct.
Among all the people and organizations that have played a role in Flint that were at the meeting, is that all pretty much a consensus about the way things are progressing, the things that you just spelled out?
Yes, it is. And the interesting thing about that is that we looked at it a number of different ways. So the state of Michigan conducted a very full sampling study with many different rounds. EPA did as well with a different protocol. And Dr. Edwards, as I think you know, since August of 2015, conducted his sampling in a number of different rounds. All the sampling was done differently. So we all had different methodologies, different ways to analyze it. And the interesting thing about it is that it all converged. It all showed the system getting better in exactly the same way I just set out. The lead is decreasing quite a bit, and we're not seeing the problems with disinfection byproducts. We are seeing good chlorine residual. So it really all came up the same way, coming at it from different angles.
What issues might still be in dispute, or issues that everyone has not yet reached consensus regarding data or what it means or on ways forward?
There are a number of different policy issues that are in front of us. One of the most important is what happens with bottled water. The state has been providing bottled water for a year now. So how long does that continue? Another issue is as to filters, and I don't mean the efficacy of filters. That's not in doubt. It really is to what's the best management practices going forward for use of the filters. Those sorts of things are issues that we're confronting and that we're all working together on. There's also an issue, I'd say, of when are we done? When are we across the finish line? Because we've been saying for quite some time that things are getting better. And a lot of the things we talked about today shed some light on those questions.
And I think the people in Flint who've been living with this for some time now, the better part of 3 years now, have that question in mind. When do you cross the finish line? What does the finish line look like in your view?
So the most important thing is safe water. And right now we're looking at it in terms of filters. And we know that if people use filters, we are absolutely certain that no matter what incoming lead levels we see, the filters effectively reduce that incoming level to either non-detect or just barely detectable levels. So that's one thing that we know for certain. We also know that filter use is important going forward, even as levels fall. So we could have a very large percentage of homes below the EPA action level of 15 parts per billion. But because lead lines are unpredictable, not just in Flint but elsewhere, people might want to consider using filters in Flint and elsewhere where there are sensitive populations, including children. The other thing to keep in mind with regard to filters is that they have to be maintained. So the state has a very effective program called the Core Group, where they go out and talk to residents about filter use. They are very actively making sure that people are installing the filters correctly and maintaining them in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendations.
I'm speaking with Robert Kaplan, who's the acting regional administrator for EPA Region 5, as we break down the big meeting that happened Tuesday at the office in Chicago, focusing on Flint. And Robert, so many people want to know if and when Flint will get the all clear. But I'm wondering, is that kind of message really even possible to give when we've got, you know, lead water lines and lead fixtures in those water lines?
That's a really good question. And one of the things that came out of the conversation today was that we profiled where the lead is coming from. We have a very good handle on the sources of it. We know it's not coming from the plant. We know it's not coming from the water lines. The contribution that was coming from the lead service line, which is the connection between the street and the house, is now really minimized due to good corrosion control. As you point out, there are fixtures in the house, especially those that were made decades ago, that still contain either brass in the fixture or brass in the solder. They can also trap lead that has come from other sources. And what we found from the scientific meeting today is that a large portion of the above 15 parts per billion households, large portion of the lead is coming from inside the house. It's coming from those fixtures, and it's coming from the trapped lead. So the solution to that really is twofold. The first is continuing with the corrosion control. That means beating the orthophosphate and bringing that into the house, using the water and making sure that that chemical bonds with the fixtures and helps provide corrosion control. The second is using the water, and that means flushing the water through and making sure the particles of lead that have accumulated get pushed through the system and pushed out into the drain and are not available. So in those two ways, you really minimize exposures.
You mentioned the need to continue using filters. And so if that's a continual recommendation in Flint, do you see the EPA recommending that other cities relay this kind of cautionary message as well? I mean, as long as we're talking about lead water lines and fixtures, shouldn't people take precautions?
Flint has brought a lot to the fore. As you know, the lead and copper rule, which is EPA's protective rule for water systems, has been under reconsideration for a number of years now. This has really shined a light on the need to make some changes in the lead and copper rule. And I'm pleased to say that EPA is using the experience in Flint to guide its efforts going forward to revise the lead and copper rule. One of the suggestions that's been made is that filter use should be expanded, and that's something that EPA is considering.
It's certainly clear that many cities just don't even know where lead service lines exist in their systems, and EPA regulations require them to know this information. How will the EPA help cities complete these material inventories?
And that's an excellent point. It's something that we learned in Flint, that you have information that's decades old and oftentimes very inaccurate about where the lead lines are. In fact, in Flint itself, we found the information was on very old 3x5 cards and didn't often match up with reality. That's common throughout the country, and the rule depends on your ability to find those lead lines to know where they are. So EPA gave a grant to the city, and the city is using that grant to find ways to figure out where the lead lines are. General McDaniel, who's leading the Fast Start effort, is pioneering that effort in conjunction with EPA's Office of Research and Development to figure out ways to identify where the lead lines are. That's going to help in Flint as they go forward and replace their lead lines, but it's also going to help nationwide as people have better ways to figure out where the lead lines are actually buried.
Because this is staggering to think, here is Flint. That is a pinprick, literally, on the map of the United States. The scope of what needs to be accomplished is pretty overwhelming.
There are tens of thousands of lines in Flint, and there are millions across the country, so that's exactly right.
There are people, Robert, who live in Flint, who remember that when they first started coming into City Hall and showing their bottles of orange-colored water and eyelashes and hair started falling out, plenty of officials didn't really act to help them. And we don't need to go through the litany. We know it well. But it is certainly seen as a failure of government at all levels, and particularly the state of Michigan and the EPA. What do you say to those people? How do you work to regain that shattered trust?
I think the most important aspect of restoring trust is transparency. And that's what we're doing here in Flint. One of the key things that we've done is every time we take any data, we take a sample, we map it out on GIS platform, we put it directly up on our website so people can find, with just a couple of mouse clicks, all the sampling that we've done. So the information that we have is available to people. We also have a number of open houses. We have had a number of open houses to share that information and interpret it for people. And it's not just with EPA, it's with federal, state, and local agencies all in partnership working together to actively interpret the information for people one-on-one and provide them with the information they need to make decisions, not just about lead, but also about nutrition, housing, ways forward, learning, all the things that people need to do to deal with this crisis. So you asked about restoring trust, and that's really the best way is that interaction based on transparency.
So one of the many lessons that we learned from the Flint water crisis is this delicate relation between the EPA and state agencies. And as we've come to learn, the EPA dragged its feet in deference to officials at our state's Department of Environmental Quality. And I'm wondering, moving forward, have you got a clearer idea at what point the EPA must come in and take control of the situation, whether it's in Michigan or Oregon or wherever, when state officials aren't complying with federal law? Basically, when is it time to take the keys to the car away from the state?
So let me first take issue with the premise and say that as far as the dragging our feet, there are plenty of reports out there, and I'll let them speak for themselves. I wasn't actually involved at the time, so I can read those reports as well as you. But I believe that we did work with the state to move them out of the water source that they are on, which was an important first step, and move them directly into orthophosphate corrosion control as quickly as possible. But your basic point, which is federal oversight of states, is a really key one. It's a mandate that we take extremely seriously. We oversee all six states in Region 5 very carefully, and especially with something as important as drinking water, we're going to make sure that they comply with the full program. We're going to be very actively looking at their program implementation, their enforcement, the advice that they're giving to those that they regulate, and making sure that they're on the job. So we see that as a priority. We see that as job one. It comes from the president to the administrator down to me as something that we need to execute absolutely fully. We will, and we have.
So now what? What are the priorities for the EPA concerning Flint moving ahead?
I think the most important thing right now is to communicate about the results that we've seen. I think not many people know the progress that we've made. As I've been to Flint and I've interacted with residents, been in people's homes, there are a lot of misconceptions about where we are. And I've always seen this as a community engagement exercise, really important to communicate exactly where we are and what the path is forward in terms of water quality. And the basic message to people, I hope they will know this after the meeting from Flint and going forward, is that the water system in many respects has been restored to the baseline, to the level it was pre-crisis. And the thing that really differentiates Flint now from other cities is Flint has a sharp eye on the problem, has all the expertise necessary to fix the problem, and most importantly, the resources that almost every other community lacks to deal with this problem. When I say the resources, Congress just appropriated $170 million that's going to be used to take it well beyond the baseline, not just returning it to where it was before, but getting the lead out of Flint in every respect. So that's really the path forward for Flint. It's communication about where we are, and then going forward with the improvements that we intend to make.
You raise that big penultimate question of when do we cross the finish line. I don't think I'm hearing you say that the finish line has been crossed yet, do I?
No, I think that's right. And I will hasten to add that the finish line is elusive. It's not a number. So the finish line is sort of an elusive concept, not just in Flint, but in every community. The 15 parts per billion I don't see as necessarily a be-all and end-all. It's really something where we get the experts together, just as we did here today, discuss it, see where we are, see where the lead is coming from, and come to a recommendation. And then the recommendation has to be considered by policymakers, and they have to consider all the risk factors involved and then make a determination based on that. We had the good fortune to have Mayor Weaver with us today, so she heard all of it. She's, I know, going to be talking to the governor, and they're going to be working through this in conjunction with EPA and other federal officials. So I think this is more of a process than a number that is the finish line.
It is stunning to think of the way environmental law students are going to be learning from all of this for decades to come.
Whenever I talk about Flint, I always say that any part of this could be a graduate-level course. And that's exactly right. It's environmental law. It's science policy. It's just about everything that we do all wrapped into one. And the most important aspect of it really is it's returning to normalcy for a city of nearly 100,000 people. That's our ultimate goal, making sure that the water is safe and drinkable for everyone.
Robert Kaplan, Acting Regional Administrator for the EPA Region 5, with us from Chicago. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.